Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're with us on the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Just after 1 p.m. this fine Tuesday. Really excited to be back in the studio with you, joined by my wonderful compatriots, Greg Nicholson. How are you doing?
I'm actually a little bit stressed. In the car on the way here, we're talking only about Game of Thrones. And now I can't quite calm down.
Which is why Ranjani's with us. Ranjani, you're going to break down the last episode and what we can learn from it in terms of analyzing South African politics.
Oh my gosh. South African politics will flatten Game of Thrones anytime. So that's what I'm here
for. It sounds quite similar. Just a bunch of old people trying to fight for territory. So maybe not.
Power and privilege,
pretty
basically.
Much South African politics.
Just with it, minus the dragons.
Okay, yeah, that's. I'm sure there's a metaphor in there somewhere. We need pop lag for that. Anyway, the real story of this week is not happening in King's Landing. It's happening in Midrand. Ranjani, the gathering.
Yes, we're very excited. It's on Friday. I hope a lot of our listeners are coming. If you haven't booked tickets, you better book them straight away because as far as I know, we are almost at capacity.
What is it for those who don't know?
I'm going to tell you now. Okay, so the gathering is an annual event hosted by Daily Maverick. And what we do is we aim to bring all the major political players and the people who basically run the affairs of South Africa under one roof, and we give them an opportunity to speak, and then we put a whole range of questions to them. But in between, we also have South Africa's premier comedians. We have some poetry. So it's entertainment, but it's also information. It's empowering information. It's knowledge about the country. And it's basically Daily Maverick in motion. So last year was a major success. Last year we had some major news coming out of the gathering as well, with people like Paul Mashatile, dropping some bombs while they were speaking. And this year we're hoping the same thing will happen. We've got quite a lineup. We initially intended to have the Deputy President of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa. His office had initially confirmed. But then we were told he has time constraints. So initially he was just supposed to come to speak and not answer questions. Now that would actually defeat the point of being there because we can hear him speak anyway. Yeah. And I think it's the questions and, you know, the interaction that makes the gathering what it is. Mm. So now what we've got is the Treasurer General of the ANC, Dr. Zweli Mkhize. He is quite willing and ready to answer all our questions. And yeah, he's a member of the ANC top six. He's quite a player in South African politics. He's said to have the president's ear. So we are really looking forward to it. So he's going to open up the gathering this year. And then after that, we have the leader of the Democratic Alliance, Musi Maimane, followed by the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters, Julius Malema. So if you're coming, make sure you're there by 8 o'clock because we're going to kick off early and that session is bound to trend. And then thereafter, we have the mayoral debates for the candidates from the city of Joburg. Mm. So you're going to have Mayor Parks Tau and the contender for the job, Herman Mashaba. And a surprise contender. The Economic Freedom Fighters have not announced their mayoral candidates. So instead of the mayoral candidate, we have the number two in the EFF, Floyd Chivambu, will be participating in the that debate. So the morning political session is going to be really exciting. Mm. And in the afternoon, we've got a big debate on the state of South Africa. And the people, among the people who are on that panel, will be Jay Naidu, the former minister and now a global activist. We've got Sasonke Msimang, who's a columnist for Daily Maverick, and she's also quite an outspoken activist and social commentator. We've got Ira Jabidian, who's an economist. Mark Haywood, who's also an activist at Section 27. And Zwelinzi Mavavi is down but not out. He still has a lot of interesting things to say, and he's still got big plans in the works, but he's also an important voice still on the situation of South Africa. And we've got a surprise guest. I can't tell you who it is, but he is a really, really exciting guest.
We don't even know. I don't even know who that is.
Yes.
Duncan is asking if it's Donald Trump. You can't confirm nor deny.
He's a person who's been in the news for a while and is quite a controversial figure. Okay. Yeah. And we will close the gathering on Friday afternoon with the one and only, the most South Africa's most wanted, Pravin Gordhan.
Okay, let's hope he doesn't get arrested.
I know.
That's not funny. That's actually a disaster. If he's like, no, I can't come. Let's not laugh about that. And Jenny, just last thing on this, just with the political tension in the country and the headlines, it just feels like this year's gathering has an extra sort of excitement.
It is.
What are they going to say? What's going to, how does it
affect? I know, it's so unpredictable. That's the thing, you know. And the thing about the gathering is, like Cliff Central, it's unscripted. Whatever happens, happens, and we deal with it, you know. So we have no idea what anybody's going to say there. But we're going to be ever and willing and ready to put the hard questions to them.
That's it. If you're listening in and want to know where to get the tickets, you can go straight to Daily Maverick website. It's right at the top. Or you can go to Ticket Pro. As Ranjeni mentioned, you know, they're flying like hotcakes. So, you know, get one now or else. And don't tweet us asking for free tickets.
And if you miss out on the opportunity to be there for whatever reason, you can watch it on live streaming via ENCA.com. And there will be a link from the Daily Maverick website as well. So if by any chance you're not in Johannesburg or you're not able to attend, make sure that you follow it on live streaming. And the hashtag for the day will be Nando's DM Gathering.
That's it. Duncan's also asking if there's free Nando's. At this point, I'm going to stop listening to him. Clearly, there's not much.
Well, actually, I mean, it's not that outrageous a question, because last year we gave out vouchers for Nando's. So
I know I got socks from last year.
Yes, I got socks.
I might be wearing them right now.
Nando's socks.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
And they gave you in pairs of three, or rather in threes, because one's going to go missing. And I thought that was so clever. No, just me. Nando's feeding the nation. Anyway, that's tough. Like, I'm not even getting paid. Why am I doing this? Anyway, if you want to talk to us right now, at DM Shows at A, we're tweeting there, and you can call in as usual, 0861-555-189. And Jenny, now to look at some of the headlines from late last week and the weekend. It looks like the SACP and ANC are not really on the same page anymore.
Well, I don't know. You know, I think the SACP has always been on a different page altogether. But, you know, it's been quite strange because for a while they disappeared off the scene completely. You didn't really bother too much about the SACP. I was going through a phase where I actually wasn't even reading their statements anymore. It was just normally, you know, their statements would be, we note this, we welcome that, and that's about it.
At the most, there was a good couple of years there where it seemed the most interesting thing they were saying was just defending the president.
Yes.
Very, very strongly.
Yep.
That was about the most interesting thing they were doing.
And the only thing they came up in, there was fingers pointed at them in terms of their role in the COSATU fallout and the COSATU divisions. People were pointing fingers at them. So look, the SACP has been off the political scene for a while, but they've come back with a bang. And the reason for that is that they are now the most vocal critic of state capture. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the term state capture came from them. And they're the ones been pursuing this issue. So it was the SACP Second Deputy General Secretary, Solly Maphaela, who raised this at the Alliance Summit. He put it on the agenda, and he's the one who forced the ANC to deal with this issue. So it was out of that pressure from the SACP that the ANC National Executive Committee then decided to mandate the Office of the Secretary General, that's Gwede Mantashe, along with the National Working Committee to investigate the issue of state capture. And by state capture, that's kind of a euphemism now for the influence of the Guptas.
Yeah.
So we know exactly what they're talking about. So, and we know that everybody else in the ANC is kind of tiptoeing around the Guptas. And, you know, I don't know why that is. I don't know why people are scared of them, or maybe they're not scared. Maybe there are other reasons why they decide not to speak out on them. But the SACP has definitely been extremely bold on the issue. So when the ANC announced after its NEC meeting this weekend, that, 2 weeks ago, that it was dropping the probe, the SACP went into a fit of rage. I mean, we've never seen such strong language coming out of the SACP. They were calling it a whitewash. They were saying there's rot in the ANC. They were accusing them of, colluding with these people. And The very strange statement from Solly Maphaila was that why are we would refuse to be in alliance with this faction in the ANC. So that was quite a strong statement. So there was always a risk that this past weekend Central Committee of the SACP would like backtrack a little bit, because that was quite hard language, you know, against their alliance partner. So I went to this media briefing on Sunday thinking, oh gosh, these people are definitely going to backpedal on this. You know, there's no way they can keep up the pressure.
They've gone too far and they're going to like turn it down.
So when we walked into the briefing room, it was quite hilarious because Blaine Nzimande then looks around, because the entire Central Committee was still sitting in their chairs and we were called in for a media briefing. So there was no place. So we were just standing and like staring at him, and he said, "I'm inviting you to take a pot shot of the Central Committee." And we were like, "What? A pot shot? You mean a photo op? Yes, that's what I mean." Okay, so he wanted us to know that there was unanimity in that meeting, that there was support for whatever they were going to announce.
Okay.
So it was just not him and Jeremy Cronin and Solly saying these things. So it was interesting. So people did the pot shot, and so then we had the media briefing, and like the first few paragraphs of that statement came out very clearly saying we support the position of our deputy, second deputy general secretary, Solly Maphaila. So they stood behind Solly, and they're basically backing up everything he is saying on state capture and the Gupta family. So that was quite a surprising development.
Tell me, we're hearing a lot from Solly around this issue, has been really vocal, as well as the spokesperson, I'm pretty sure, Alex.
Yes, Alex, yes. Yeah.
One thing I'm wondering, though, is Blade Nzimande, the leader of the SACP, hasn't taken a stronger voice. Did you get, from this briefing, did you get that he was fully behind these issues, or is he in a bit more of a more difficult space, being in cabinet, being close to some of Zuma's allies?
Look, this is the problem with that alliance, because Blade Nzimande, not only is he in cabinet, but he's also a member of the NEC.
Yeah.
So if the NEC has taken that decision, he's bound by that decision. So if you're straddling both organizations, what do you do? Your organization say, we demand an investigation into state capture. The NEC, NEC says, we're dropping the probe into state capture. Then what happens? But he was the one reading the statement.
Yeah.
And he and Jeremy Cronin were quite willing to stand by Solly. And they said, you know, look, where there was this whole ducking and diving game was, who exactly are you pointing fingers at? Because if the Gupta family has insider information, I mean, Jeremy Cronin has made this allegation that there was a deliberate shorting of the rand when Nhlanhla Nene was fired.
Okay.
So he's saying somebody knew beforehand that Nhlanhla Nene was going to be fired. So what they did is that they sold off their rands and they bought dollars. Because they knew what was going to happen, and then they made a major killing basically because the rand fell so badly. So when we then asked them, so who would have given the Guptas that, or whoever it is, that information? Then there's this whole obstacle race they run, you know. Then they don't want to answer directly. And it was in that issue in particular, Blaine Nzimande said, you know, was trying to say, look, we're not pointing fingers at any single person. It's the phenomenon of state capture. So around that, they're fuzzy. But they are saying that they want to pursue this investigation. They're now going to go to the South African Council of Churches, because apparently the South African Council of Churches has made available a legal team and researchers to be able to help whoever wants to complain or to take these complaints forward.
Okay.
So, and that team is led by George Bezos. So the SACP wants to go there, which is hilarious, I think, because the SACP has been a vocal critic of civil society and activists in civil society. And all of a sudden, they need to now resort to their help in order to take a stand against the ANC.
They have been some of the harshest critics
of
the foreign-funded, white minority capital.
Exactly.
Sort of civil society imperialists.
Yes. But also, I mean, you can't ignore the fact that communists are going to the churches. There's a whole ideological contradiction there.
Are we seeing a deepening division of factionalism within intra-alliance politics? Particularly, it seems to be over this issue of state capture. Are there sort of different camps forming?
Look, the dominant faction or the leadership of the ANC is clear that they want to run away from this issue. Okay. But from what we're hearing, there are people in the ANC who are secretly backing and urging the SACP forward to say, continue on this line because, you know, we're being bullied. Mm. The Premier League is the one who's supporting the Guptas. We don't, but we can't say anything. And there's also the delicate issue of the role of President Jacob Zuma, because if you pursue this to the issue of state capture to its logical conclusion, the one person who does, you know, all kind of fingers point to is President Zuma. And he would have made the decision on Nhlanhla Nene. So who would have given the Guptas that information, or who would have given anybody information? I mean, the most recent allegation that the SACP has made was that the Guptas knew about the election date before it was announced. And they told people in the Northwest, Northern Cape, I beg your pardon, about this. These Northern Cape leaders then mentioned it at an alliance summit that was attended by Gwede Matasha and Balega Mpete. And they said, but where did you get this from? Like, did you see it on social media? No. The Guptas told, one of the Gupta brothers told us.
Sure.
Yeah, and these people were beyond. Solly says that both Gwede and Balega were like, you know, astounded that this happened, and they said, "Look, we'll call others who were there." They called the provincial chairman of the ANC in the Northern Cape, and he said, "Yes, yeah. It was a Gupta brother who told us." So obviously, they have an inside track. Now, where do they get that information from? But when it comes to the faction, the other dynamic here is COSATU, because the SACP doesn't have big numbers. So it's saying it's going to embark on a mass action campaign against state capture. It's going to rope COSATU in. COSATU is running for the hills. It does not want to touch the issue of state capture. If anything, Stuma Dlamini made the most astounding statement when the Guptas fled to Dubai to say, "Oh, I've spoken to them. Don't worry. They're coming back," as if, you know, we all wanted them to
come back.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
so, you know, I don't know where COSATU stands on the issue. They've been saying that...
It seems COSATU's ability to perhaps stand up against a certain faction of the ANC has been significantly diminished. Since NUMSA and Vavi
left,
both expelled.
So they're trying to be more cooperative with the ANC and not be to take on that kind of troublemaker role. But the problem is that there are principled issues here. So if you know about state capture, if you know about the perversive effect of you know, that anyone is having, and you don't speak out on it, you can be compromised. So the SACP says it's going to lobby the COSATU to join them on this campaign. But I don't know if they're going to do that.
Just before we move on, we spoke before about about the SACP's years almost in the wilderness. What do you think's driven them to take this strong stance? Is it just a principled decision, or are there other political motivations pushing or encouraging the SACP to stand up?
Look, there is another agenda behind the whole thing, and this is these factional battles in the ANC, and ultimately the succession battle that will play out next year. But I think if you look at it, if you take a broad kind of overview of it, it's the SACP is bucking the trend of the Premier League. So they're going to head-to-head with this faction that's known as the Premier League. The Premier League kind of dovetails with the interests of the Gupta family and those who have been working in tandem with the Guptas. And the SACP is trying to oppose anything that the Premier League is kind of pursuing as their agenda. So the Guptas is one issue, but then you see it playing out now with the compilation of lists for the local government election campaign, where the SACP has also been a vocal critic of how those lists are compiled, because Blade Nzimande said at this media briefing that they will not support any candidates who came through fraudulent processes, and there are lots of allegations of that in several provinces, which the SACP has been vocal about. So they're saying that the dominant faction of the ANC, also known as the Premier League, is basically manipulating this list process to get their people on the list and ultimately elected onto municipalities, so that the dominance of the Premier League then remains and it sort of penetrates into the local government sphere.
I mean, we've been hearing a lot of I didn't mean to say spear.
That's all right. Lighten the mood a bit. Spear is a loaded term.
Freudian slip.
I got a good giggle. Greg, I know you were reading about this also, just about what's playing out down in KZN and how some of these national teams were seeing and how they're playing out at a provincial level.
Well, back to the newsmakers of the month, I think it is, the SACP. It's SACP, KZN Secretary Tembo Ntembu was surprisingly offered a position in the cabinet of new Premier Willie Zimkunu. Ranjini, you know a little bit more about that, don't you? Because he was a strong critic, wasn't he, of the change in government. In fact,
Tembo Ntembu was at the SACP Central Committee this weekend. I saw him there and he looked really grumpy and angry about like what's been going on in KZN. And the SACP also spoke out harshly on this issue. They were totally against the recall of Senzo Mkunu. They said that it would cause further divisions in KZN. They're definitely opposed to the cabinet reshuffle. So they were caught completely off guard when yesterday the new premier, Willis Mkunu, then announced that Tembo Ntembu would be one of the new MECs. So he didn't react immediately, but he didn't go to be sworn in this morning because there were consultations within his party as to whether to accept it or not. Because you can't say, I'm opposed to this, and then
you're then
part of the new
is it an olive branch from Sihle Zikalala's camp in KZN?
I think it was just a good move to outmaneuver the SACP because they basically they were stuck between a rock and a hard place on this issue, because if he didn't accept the MEC position, it means he wants to stand on the sidelines and shout at the ANC. It means that he just wants to continue to be critical without wanting to contribute to building the province, you know, in ANC parlance, that's what they say, you know, build the unity and advance the interests of the National Democratic Revolution, blah, blah. So, you know, if he goes against that, then he's seen to just be a counter-revolutionary force or something. Whereas if he's now accepted the position of MEC for agriculture, what it does is that it brings him on board this agenda that this new faction has. Look, one of the allegations is that they want the new leadership in the province to assist the ANC in its election campaign.
Understandably.
So they basically want the KZN government to subsidize, to assist the ANC in its campaigning. So, if he is now an MEC, does he go there and say, no, I'm not going to support the ANC campaign? Then why are you there? If he takes the position and says, no, I'm here for an... he can't basically say, I'm here to carry out the program or the mandate of the SACP, because he's not there on an SACP ticket. The SACP didn't fight that election. He's there on an ANC ticket, which means he's bound to implement whatever the ANC tells him to do. So that's the dilemma. And you've seen it at a national level where people who are in the national parliament or in cabinet, so people like Tulas Ngesi, Blaine Nzimande, Jeremy Cronin, they are there. They're still leaders in the SACP. But when they are in cabinet or in parliament, they have to implement what is the program of the ANC. So they can't do their own thing. They can't vote against positions of the ANC. So this is what's going to now happen with Tembo Ntembu in KZN. So although he's been critical of this faction, he's now basically taken the job and agreed to do whatever they want him to do.
And I read it in the Mail and Guardian, I think it was a very sort of low-key allegation that the Premier League was behind some of the violence that's playing out in KZN. I think two SACP members were killed, I think leaving a party meeting or leaving some kind of conferencing, and they were killed. And there seems to be just allegations that some big players are behind some of the violence going on there.
Well, this is the thing, because the SACP has made these allegations very strongly. So this is why it's even stranger move that all of a sudden Tembo Ntembu is now part of the provincial government, because he is basically been accusing that dominant faction in KZN who now running the government of being behind, you know, these illicit happenings in KZN and the violence. But also, you know, as I said, with the compilation of election lists,
yep.
That, you know, they have been extremely unhappy with how the lists have been compiled. But it'll be much more difficult for him now to continue criticizing this, and those people will be on the list. How then does the SACP support those people and ensure that they are elected as councillors when they have a principled stand against them? It's really quite a dilemma for them.
Potentially a very smart move from the KZN ANC.
Oh, absolutely.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I think they did. It was, you know, a genius move really to box them in.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have on this. I know I'm about to let you go, Ranjani. Anything else we need to be watching between now and seeing you at the gathering?
No, I don't think so. Well, it's obviously the terror alert, which I believe there have been some developments today. I hear that News 24 is reporting that there's a discredited person behind the allegations, and they're getting that from South African government sources. But I believe you're going to be talking about that in the next part of the show.
Absolutely.
But other than that, it seems hopefully as like a quiet week. The president's going off to Lesotho, so. There's not much that can be happening, but there's another big event on Friday, and that is the spy tapes case. It will also be heard in court or argued. The appeal will be argued. Yes, the petition to appeal,
which will be very interesting.
It will be interesting.
Legal experts say that the presidency and the MPA will have a very difficult time getting leave to appeal.
Yes,
and if they don't get leave to appeal, the only option then will be to petition the SCA directly,
yes.
Which is going to be very interesting, because if they don't get it, there's pretty harsh ramifications for the president.
Yes, but he also has other options as well. But, I mean, let's see what happens in court and what he opts to do. But looking forward to seeing you all at the gathering.
Absolutely. I hope you'll be ready for selfies. I'm sure a lot of people want to get some selfies. She loves non-committal.
Yeah, no, I hate selfies.
We'll try again on Friday. Jenny, thank you so much. Now, to switch gears a bit, one of the big sort of topics from the weekend was about the terror threat, right? What's going on? These sort of press releases from the US Embassy. And we saw that our sort of ranking with one of the British foreign offices was increased from medium to high. So the question was, what's going on? So we reached out to Ryan Cummings, who's a director at Signal Risk, and his job is basically to use intelligence and support to mitigate security risk in Africa. So we're digging into what's going on with the terror alerts. Should we be worried? Are we prepared for any sort of situation happening? And secondly, it's been a year since Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari took office. So it's looking back at how much has he had to deliver on. He rode on a campaign of change. And of course, he had been president before, something that some people forget. So could we really expect anything different from him? So we spoke to Ryan Cummings to really break down these two topics. And yeah, here's the interview. Please give it a listen.
First, we'll be speaking about, you know, what's on everybody's minds and what's on Twitter and what everybody's talking about, which is the threat of a terror attack here in South Africa, here at home. And Ryan, I'd love to just start with the terror alerts that we received. So one was over the weekend from the U.S. Embassy, and they sort of alerted that they have information about a near-term attack locally on places where U.S. citizens congregate. And we saw 2 weeks ago the British Foreign Commonwealth Office increasing the South African terrorism rating to high. So, I mean, Ryan, I just want to hear from you. I mean, what do we believe? I mean, on one hand, it sounds like there's reason to panic with sort of these two reasons. And on the other hand, you know, we've heard alerts before and nothing happened. I mean, as recently as last year, you know, we got an alert and nothing happened. So I'm just love to hear from you. How much weight do you put on these recent alerts?
Well, I think, you know, the first issue we kind of need to consider is that the United States and many other foreign governments have a legal obligation to react, you know, to instances where they receive intelligence, you know, warning of a potential terrorist attack, security threat, or political development, which could either place their interests or citizens within a foreign country at threat. And I think that this was potentially the case here. As you know, the United States are actively monitoring various various avenues for intelligence, and there may have been some inclination, as there were, as you mentioned, you know, in 2015, there was some chat in 2009 as well about potential threats against U.S. embassies and diplomatic representations in South Africa, which prompted them to issue an advisory. And I think that this is possibly the case here. Again, how discernible and credible that threat is open to, you know, to further conversation and further dissection. But once they do receive some form of information that there could even just potentially be some form of security development, you know, placing U.S. interests and citizens at risk, they are legally obliged to react to it. But in terms of the terrorism threat in South Africa, I think, you know, what people often miss is that they tend to not see terrorist organizations as being, you know, as being like any organization, you know, that acts, you know, in a specific way to specific circumstances. One would be very, very hard pressed to find a terrorist organization that executes attacks indiscriminately. Most of the time, countries and governments and specific interests are targeted, you know, due to the respective governments' domestic and foreign policies, which usually are aimed at curtailing the, you know, the operations of terrorism groups. And I think when we look at South Africa, it's quite interesting from a domestic policy perspective, but also from a foreign policy perspective, we've completely, you know, removed ourselves from any counterterrorism or counterinsurgency operations, you know, targeting Islamist extremist groups, not only on the continent, but globally as well, you know, whether it's Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, or the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb movement. South Africa has not supported counterterrorism operations against these groups. And therefore, there isn't any reason at this stage, you know, for these organizations to be planning some form of, you know, reprisal against, you know, assets within South Africa's borders.
I mean, I love that you brought that up, because when we saw the Garissa attacks in Kenya and we saw the attacks in Paris, there was always sort of logically, even just for, you know, your day-to-day person looking at the country's involvement, there was almost a logic to this is why you are our enemy based on your policy. So you're saying based on South Africa's not local, but continental policy activity and international policy activity that we're fairly neutral in terms of matters concerning Syria and matters concerning terrorism?
Yeah, most definitely. And I think that, you know, we've kind of made that stance quite explicit, you know, in terms of our action, or sort of, should I say, inaction, you know, to conflicts that's happening across the world. I mean, South Africa has involved itself in some form of, you know, conflicts on the continent. For example, we see that, you know, the South African Defense Force plays a role in the FIB, or the Foreign Intervention Brigade, that's currently being deployed in Northeastern DRC, where they actively had curtailed, you know, the insurgent operations of groups such as the M23 and also the Hutu-based FDLR. You know, we recently saw with the crisis in the Central African Republic, you know, that the South African military also had, you know, played a role in terms of protecting the regime of Francois Bozize, you know, against the advance of the Seleka rebels. Unfortunately, it wasn't as successful as we would have liked it to have been, and it ended up with Bozize being, you know, ousted from the CAR presidency. But again, you know, we have involved ourselves in continental conflicts, but none of which have focused on, you know, Islamist extremist groups who have often, you know, lashed out at countries and governments who have, you know, provided either operational or logistical support to counterterrorism initiatives by launching attacks within their own borders. And then we also kind of need to speak to domestic policies in South Africa. I think what we would see in many countries, which is kind of congruent with terrorism and radicalization of specific communities within those countries, is how governments tend to be intolerant, you know, to certain faith groups, to certain communities. You know, for example, in Kenya, apart from the Kenyan government actually involving itself in counterterrorism operations in neighboring Somalia, we've always seen historically marginalization of the so-called ethnic Somali community, which lives in the northeast of the country, and where, you know, it was actually the domestic socioeconomic and political policies adopted by the Kenyan government which led to a homegrown terrorism threat emanating from those communities who felt, you know, completely marginalized and, you know, disenfranchised by the Kenyan government in South Africa. You know, we are a secular country first and foremost, but there is a high degree of tolerance for a number of, you know, minorities, whether that be, you know, from a racial perspective or from a religious and cultural perspective. So again, you know, all of those, you know, all of those little political, social and economic grievances that one almost associates with the proliferation and development of homegrown terrorism and domestic terrorism is just kind of missing in this country, which I think is another reason why, you know, we haven't been targeted in the terrorist attack, you know, either from a domestic group or from a transnational entity.
I mean, some people point to South African individuals' involvement with terrorist activity, and they point to South Africans that have been found, perhaps after they're deceased, and their paperwork is South African, or arrested in transit to go and join ISIS. And they say perhaps they're not large groups, but there seems to be some individuals who are heeding the call to join ISIS or feel some kind of resonance with their cause. And where do you think this comes from, these sort of individuals who want to be a part of this? And could that be a reason perhaps where there's some cause for concern locally?
Yeah, that's actually a very, very good point. I think what we need to notice is that the advent of the Islamic State and their specific expansionary model has seen an evolution in terrorism. I mean, usually you'd have groups such as Al-Qaeda who branched out, you know, from their so-called birthplace in South Asia and in, you know, Waziristan region of Pakistan and, you know, which obviously borders Afghanistan. And they were able to set up, you know, little operational cells across the world, generally linking on to countries where you already had, you know, so-called Islamist extremist groups with local grievances against the government. And then what Al-Qaeda would do is kind of, you know, brand these guys as Al-Qaeda franchises, you know, by giving them logistical and financial support and kind of calling on them to not only, you know, fight their domestic battles, but also further the Al-Qaeda, you know, so-called raison d'etre of, you know, overthrowing Middle Eastern regimes, and by doing so, you know, to focus attacks on Western governments, you know, within these areas, and the reason being to kind of, you know, see Western governments just removing themselves from these contexts and stopping their support for governments within these areas, and specifically for governments within the Middle East, because, you know, the belief for Al-Qaeda is that, you know, with a lot of these countries' support, I mean, I focus a lot on the Middle East, but we can extend this to much of the Arab world and even to large parts of West Africa. The sentiment is that if Western governments stop their patronage of North African regimes, of certain West Africa regimes, then, you know, these governments would effectively just crumble. And then you'd have large Muslim communities that's going to ready for radicalization and ready to kind of, you know, lead to the achievement of Al-Qaeda's goal, which is the goal of the Islamic State as well, which is this unification of the Muslim world, you know, that is governed, you know, strictly under the principles of Sharia law. But what the Islamic State has done is, you know, it's been able to permeate areas where there aren't any specific Islamist extremist groups that are operating or that has specific gripes with the governments. What they've been able to do is kind of, you know, focus on the individual who personally feels marginalized, who personally feels a disconnect from his government, and they've been able to turn this individual as an operative, you know, without necessarily being affiliated to the group. We've seen these lone wolf actors committing acts of terrorism on the behalf of the Islamic State, you know, but they've never probably met, you know, any individuals of the Islamic State. They've just been completely self-radicalized. So this is a type of terrorism phenomenon which is so difficult to predict, you know, and so difficult to obviously plan against, because you basically have to go, you know, into the psyche of an individual, you know, looking at the propaganda from his laptop screen and then acting on it. So again, you know, this is the type of threat where we just cannot simply discount it from occurring in South Africa. And specifically when we've seen that there are individuals within the South African community who seems to find resonance with the message that is sent by Islamic State. I mean, you know, we've obviously seen reports of families and individuals who've been intercepted whilst on route to traveling to the Levant, you know, to live in the caliphate, you know, in Iraq and Syria. There have even been reports of, you know, provided by the Iraqi ambassador, who suggested that he's got information of South African nationals who were killed while fighting alongside the Islamic State, you know, and that their deaths have been covered up as road accidents, you know, and presented, to their families in this regard. There was also, interestingly enough, I think it was earlier this year, where some Shiite militias who've been actively fighting the Islamic State in Iraq came across a group of Islamic State combatants that they had killed, and they found a South African driver's license on one of these individuals. So there's definitely the concern that, you know, the Islamic State's message is resonating among some South Africans. Many of them are choosing to fight and to travel to the caliphate, but there may be a few who would just want to kind of bring the war to the home front and potentially, you know, execute attacks against, you know, Islamic State's greatest adversaries, which is obviously, you know, Western governments that are actively countering the group, not only in the Levant, but also in the more recently in North Africa, specifically in Libya. So that is a concern, and it's definitely not something that we can't take off the table at this time.
I hear you. One of my final questions on this is just about this idea that South Africa is a safe haven for recruits. So this idea, and this was very popular, especially post the Garissa attack in Kenya, and there was conversations about the so-called white widow, Samantha Luthwaite. And there was this idea that South Africa is a great place to be in transit or a safe haven. And some people point to this as a reason why the country would remain safe, because it's working as a safe house, so to speak. Well, what is your take on that?
Well, I think it's difficult to disagree with the evidence. You know, take the Luthwaite angle away. I mean, that is something, you know, whether Samantha Luthwaite ever had discernible ties to Al-Shabaab is open for debate. You know, even if she did, there's just no evidence to suggest that she had played any operational role within the group, that, you know, that she was any form of a significant asset to them. But what was interesting was post-Westgate attack, the Kenyan intelligence had released a report which was actually somehow, you know, made public by Al Jazeera. And you know, the contents of the report were quite frightening, because a lot of the information contained in this briefing suggested that the Kenyan intelligence had on a number of occasions thwarted Al-Shabaab plots within Kenya. And one of these plots, which was masterminded by the same individual behind the Westgate attack, this was an Al-Shabaab operative by the nom de guerre of Ikrima, was to target a number of key installations within Nairobi. If I'm not mistaken, I think the Kenyan parliament was one of those facilities that was supposed to be targeted in Ikrima's plots. And it actually had mentioned that the attack was going to be commissioned via the use of South African-trained Al-Shabaab operatives. So this was, you know, kind of the more really discernible evidence of South African links to the Al-Shabaab movement. But even preceding that, I mean, there's been a number of cases of, you know, designated terrorists, I should say, you know, being arrested and found to be in the possession of South African documentation, whether that was fraudulent or whether it was legitimate documentation, it's still open to debate. But, you know, they were traveling on South African documents. That was the chosen form of documentation by these individuals. There was also some instances showing that they had resided in South Africa at some point in time. So, you know, we've also seen, you know, back on the Al-Shabaab issue, there was an interesting study done by the Institute of Security Studies, one of their senior researchers, Annelie Buerta, who had herself claimed that she had interviewed some Somali nationals who claim to be Al-Shabaab operatives and claim to have been, you know, residing in South Africa, receiving training more from a logistical perspective, but definitely with discernible links to the organization. So the information is there. It is out there. And, you know, I think it's difficult to argue against the point that South Africa, you know, could not be used you know, as a operation, or should I say, as a logistical and financing hub for some of these groups. I think, you know, we kind of always focus on the terrorism angle, but what we'll often find is that certain countries that host, you know, transnationalist criminal syndicates, you know, why would they not host terrorism networks as well, you know, because you kind of are operating, you know, in the same space and using the same mechanisms to kind of fly under the radar. And it does make sense that to a certain degree, and I wouldn't say necessarily immunizes one against the, you know, threat of attack, but it does lower the threat considerably. You know, a perfect example was, you know, during the Westgate attack or prior to the Westgate attack, Kenya was seen as Al-Shabaab's probably the most important logistical and financial base outside of Somalia. You know, unfortunately, there was a spate of kidnappings that occurred in the northern regions of the country, the coastal regions of the country, and then we saw the Kenyan military involving itself in Somalia, and then there was obviously the Westgate attack, which launched a significant crackdown on Al-Shabaab operations, not as much, well, in addition to Somalia, but also in Kenya, which kind of dismantled a lot of those networks. And let's be honest, if that was the case in South Africa, there would be considerable efforts by our government and by our security agencies to kind of detect individuals, if there are any, or any groups who are involved in operations, you know, within our borders, to kind of finance and provide, you know, logistical support to terrorism activities elsewhere, but specifically terrorism activities in countries where these groups have a legitimate gripe and grievance. You know, with the countries and authorities they're facing. And, you know, as I previously mentioned, that motivation just seems to be missing in South Africa.
I hear you, Ryan. It sounds, you know, based on our domestic and, you know, foreign policy, there might be some room to be a bit relieved and perhaps feel a bit more peaceful than the headlines are making it sound. Ryan, I'd like to just switch gears a bit and switch to a different country altogether and talk a bit about Nigeria. So it's been a year since the President Muhammadu Buhari has taken office. And, you know, as one does with these milestones, you know, a lot of us are looking back and thinking, how's he done? I look back to a year ago now, and there was such excitement about it being an actual democratic election in a country that's known for military coups and taking power by force. And his campaign was a lot about change. And I'm curious about what you think 12 months in. Do you think that excitement and sort of popular opinion and positivity around President Buhari still remains?
Well, I think it's just been a very difficult 12 months for Buhari. And I think it's been filled with successes, but it's also been filled with some disappointments. And some of which has been outside of Buhari's control completely. And I think the most concerning of that has obviously been the dip in the you know, in the global oil price, the fact that, you know, the Nigerian economy, you know, oil revenue forms the backbone of that. And the country has been hit hard, you know, by declining oil revenues, which has kind of been compounded by the fact that we've seen a spate of terrorism attacks, you know, within the oil producing Niger Delta region, which is further, you know, impacted the country's ability of actually producing the crude oil, you know, that it needs to sell, you know, to kind of get, you know, the foreign exchange to keep its economy alive. And that's just had, you know, significant impacts for Buhari and, you know, to kind of put in place the various plans he had to reform Nigeria's economy, but also just to have the financial resources to address the myriad of security challenges that the country faces. I think, you know, first and foremost of these challenges is obviously the Boko Haram insurgency, you know, and the impact that it's had on the country. But I think it is one of the silver linings of the Buhari regime. You know, it was kind of, I would tend to say that the Boko Haram issue burgeoned under the tenure of President Goodluck Jonathan. And I think that inaction or indecision, I should say, by his government kind of saw this issue spiral out of control and, you know, to the point where it's become, you know, one of the most deadliest insurgencies, you know, in modern times. I think there was a report last year, which, you know, is still open to debate, that Boko Haram was ranked as the deadliest terrorism group across the world in terms of the number of fatalities the insurgency had kind of, you know, accrued over the 12 months between 2014 and 2015. But definitely under Buhari's watch, we've kind of seen a decline in Boko Haram's operations. You know, these attacks have become less frequent, they've become less deadly, and they've also become isolated, you know, to the real rural hinterlands of the country's northeast, whereas, you know, prior to his assumption of the Nigerian presidency, Boko Haram were, you know, attacking as far south as the capital, Abuja, and as far west as the city of Sokoto. Now they're kind of just operating within their traditional strongholds, which is in rural Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states in the northeast, and finding it very difficult to kind of, you know, execute these attacks in the cities, which had become, you know, a daily occurrence, you know, for much of you know, 2011 to about 2015. But most importantly, I think in the latter half of 2014, we saw Boko Haram actually assimilating territory in northeast Nigeria and actually capturing some towns. And, you know, at one point there were claims that the group had actually controlled an area the size of Belgium within Nigeria. And from what it seems is that much of rebel-held territory in Nigeria has been reclaimed. The Nigerian military seems to be gaining the upper hand against the group. Look, it's by no means claiming that the Boko Haram insurgency is dead, because I think, you know, it's still a long way to go before that is being achieved. But I think that the Nigerian government is on the correct trajectory, and I think that Buhari needs to be commended for that, you know, apart from kind of continuing the military offensive against Boko Haram position, something that's been, you know, a key aspect of his regime, was his focus on kind of mending diplomatic ties with neighbors such as Cameroon and Niger and Chad, which Nigeria historically had quite strained relations with. And Buhari has kind of made, you know, the first, you know, key points of his presidential tenure to go and visit, you know, his counterparts in these countries and kind of, you know, visit them on home soil and establish a joint framework in terms of tackling Boko Haram. And I think that has paid dividends. But there's also been aspects of his presidency which has kind of, you know, not panned out as well as it should have. I think one of the most glaring issues at the moment is his failure to kind of make explicit what his government is going to be doing in terms of the herdsman crisis that we're currently seeing in North Central, where the so-called Fulani militias, which is basically, you know, these militias that are claimed to be tied to the Fulani pastoralist group, which operates across much of North and Central Nigeria, mm-hmm. and have been claimed to be behind a lot of massacres on farming communities out in the North. You know, Buhari has not responded, you know, to this issue as decisively as many Nigerians would like to see. And again, it's one of those circumstances that if you're not going to be responding to the insecurity, you know, with the rapidity and decisiveness that you should be, all of a sudden, you know, the issue kind of burgeons out of control and you can have another Boko Haram on your hands. You know, the other issue as well is there are, you know, as I previously mentioned, renewed violence in the Niger Delta, in the oil producing region. There doesn't seem to be yet a formalized approach by the Nigerian government to deal with this. The longer this is allowed to fester, the bigger the impact it's going to have on the oil industry, the less revenue the Nigerian government is going to be able to derive, you know, from the hydrocarbon industry in the Niger Delta, and, you know, the more difficult it is going to be for the government to just meet its various financial commitments, which in itself is just going to have quite detrimental, you know, social, political, and economic impacts on the Nigerian government. So all in all, I think it's been pretty tough for Buhari, but you know, he is hoping that things might get a bit better moving forward.
That was Ryan Cummings, director at Signal Risk, just breaking down for us the terror threats in the country and, of course, wrapping up 1 year of President Muhammadu Buhari in Nigeria. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thanks for tuning in. Remember to share and download the podcast. We'll see you this Friday at the Vodacom Dome at the Gathering. Have a great week.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.